sermon. Just want to remind all of you that we're having a very special event this Shabbat. Rabbi Y.Y. Jacobson, who is one of the most famous Chabad Rabbanim in the world, is going to be with us for Shabbat. We're having a special JSS IBC joint dinner Friday night. It is free if you are in JSS or IBC. If you have not already signed up, please let me or Matt Levine know. I will be at the dinner. Yates Lieberman will be at the dinner. Matt Levine will be at the dinner. So if you'd like to attend, it's only Friday night. Please let me or Rabbi Levine know. We'll send you the Google Doc, and we'd love to see you Friday night. It's a very rare occasion. I'd love to hope to see you all there. Please let us know if you want to attend. Speak to me or Matt Levine.
Gentlemen, good morning. Please put away your phones, all the other machines. For a long time, the administration of the yeshiva has considered having an event such as today's as the Psichas Hazman, the opening of a new semester, of a new term of learning, where we can all gather together and address an issue that is on all of our minds. The reality is, and I've attended many meetings discussing the different topics that perhaps we would discuss over the course of the years. The topic that we're addressing today is not one that we ever dreamt of addressing, but is one that has, fortunately, has reared its ugly head with great proportion throughout the world and even most recently here throughout the United States. It's an age-old issue of anti-Semitism. We all know that anti-Semitism is evil, that anti-Semitism is a form of racism. But the question is, why? Why is there anti-Semitism? And if there is anti-Semitism, what can we do? Physically and spiritually, to combat anti-Semitism. What at the end of the day is the Torah's perspective on anti-Semitism? And how are we meant to react? We're very fortunate to have one of our own staff members, a person who is looked up to in communities throughout the world for his encyclopedic knowledge of everything having to do with Torah, and really everything having to do with almost all knowledge. He's a remarkable individual who has introduced Judaism to thousands through his epic work, Gateways to Judaism. And so I ask you to rise as we ask Rabbi Becker to address us on this important topic.
Thank you for the introduction. I can hardly wait to hear myself speak now. So as I'm sure you're all aware, the World Holocaust Forum is taking place in Israel. Now world leaders are gathering in Yerushalayim, in Jerusalem, hosted by Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli government, to commemorate the Holocaust and presumably to discuss ways of preventing anti-Semitism. Today, there was a trial court in Germany, in a town called Nuremberg in Germany, is discussing the issue of removing a wood carving from a church, from the Stadt Church, the town church in Nuremberg. The carving, visible from the outside of the church, is a carving of a Yudin sow. Yudin sow means a Jewish pig, which is a medieval illustration that appears in churches in Regensburg, Cologne, Nuremberg, Berlin, all throughout places in Germany, other places in Europe as well. And it depicts a pig and Jews suckling from the pig and eating its excrement, as depicted by Martin Luther in his book on the Jews and their lies. So there's a debate whether it should be removed or not. Is it part of the cultural heritage of Nuremberg? It is. Is it offensive? Yes. Should we remove it? These are debates which are actually taking place in a court today in Germany. Sounds incredible, but this is the reality. And of course, we all know of the various anti-Semitic attacks that have taken place in New Jersey, in Pittsburgh, in New York, and continuous assaults. And I'm sure some of you have experienced anti-Semitism in your life. Some of you have experienced anti-Semitism, hopefully not on campus, this campus at least, but hopefully you have not experienced it here, but you have experienced anti-Semitism. My wife was telling me that, you know, when she goes to stores at the mall, when she wears her shakel, which is a wig that religious women wear, she's treated one way. When she goes in with a kerchief on her head, a tichel, where it's more obvious that she is a Jewish woman, she is treated differently, not as well. She detected this, and I think she's probably accurate. Anti-Semitism is an interesting topic to begin the semester with. In my opinion, it's a bit of a downer. But what I would like to try to look at are is the upside of anti-Semitism. I know that's hard to see, but I believe there is an inspirational upside to it. There is a positive component to it. Let's first of all, a brief survey, universality of anti-Semitism. And as Woody Allen pointed out, Jewish, by the way, his parents sent him to interfaith camp every summer. He says, there he was beaten equally by people of all races and creeds. And indeed, anti-Semitism does come from many different directions. We know that the Baptist Convention, Southern Baptist Convention, voted for BDS, which is the boycott, divestment and sanctioning of the State of Israel. They did not vote for BDS against any other country that I'm aware of, North Korea, Iran, Iraq, Libya, Yemen, etc. United Nations recently condemned Israel, which is a minhag, it's nothing personal. But recently, interestingly enough, they condemned Israel for human rights abuses. On the council, the Human Rights Council of the United Nations, Libya was one of the governments that was sitting on the council. China, for example. These are nations that are experts in human rights abuse, and that's why they're on the council. But they basically continuously are condemning Israel. It's obviously singled out. We have from Muslims as well, as we well know, not all Muslims, but we have the Hezbollah, terrorist organization recently recognized by three other countries in South America as a terrorist organization, as the United States designates it. But Hezbollah, Hamas, in their founding charter, in the charter of the Islamic resistance movement of Hamas, they quote from a Bukhari hadith, it's part of the Islamic oral tradition, and in that hadith they write, our struggle with the Jews will not end until a Jew hides behind a rock or a tree, and the rock and tree cry out and say, O Muslim, there is a Jew hiding behind me, come and kill him. These are the people with whom we are meant to negotiate. They're not talking about territory. They're not talking about rights of Palestinians, which we acknowledge. They have rights. We acknowledge there are territorial issues. But they're talking about the elimination of Israel. Massive difference. Criticism of Israel in and of itself, that's fine. Criticism of Israel and the Israeli government does not make you an anti-Semite. Otherwise, there'd be approximately 7 million anti-Semites living in Israel today voting. But the difference is very simple. If you criticize a government, that's okay. But if you maintain that that state has no right to exist and should be eliminated from the world stage, that's not okay. That already is anti-Semitism. So we have it from Christians, we have it from Muslims, atheists, the extreme left wing. There are those who despise us. Interesting that there are leftists who are extremely opposed to the state of Israel, despite the fact that the state of Israel, at least on an official level, shares many of the values of the left in terms of equality of women's rights, in terms of freedom of press, in terms of equality for LGBTQ, etc., etc. Israel, you'd expect that they'd be allied with Israel, and yet, nevertheless, on the part of the left, there is an extreme opposition to the state of Israel, to the point where it's really hatred. It's not just criticism of policies, it's hatred. I don't know if you've ever been, I spoke on campuses outside of YU, and sometimes the vehemence of the people's opposition and their arguments is really, I can feel the hatred. It's not just, an intellectual argument, etc. I spoke at a university college in London. There was a protest outside protesting my speaking there because they declared me to be a racist, apartheid, IDF rabbi. So half of that's true. I was an IDF rabbi. But racist and apartheid? I mean, it's interesting. When I was serving in the IDF, I regularly was driving around doing guard duty on a water truck. The driver of the truck was a Bedouin. There are Muslims in my unit. Three of my sons serve in the Israeli army, one currently in the army, and all three of them have had Muslims in the unit. One of them had Christians in the unit. My daughter and daughter-in-law are both nurses in Israel. They work with Arab nurses, Arab doctors, Arab patients. Apartheid? Chutzpah, that they should serve. I don't think there are any Jewish doctors or nurses working in Damascus, Yemen, Riyadh, etc. So, but the left accuses us of apartheid and racism. So it comes from the left, and it also comes from the right, as we all know. White supremacists, neo-Nazis, etc. So we're getting it from all sides. So one of the features of anti-Semitism is this universality of it. Intensity. There's an intensity about the hatred. I mean, there are a lot of people I don't like. I'll name them afterwards. But in general, the intensity of hatred for the Jews, the attempt to literally eliminate us from the face of the planet, they attempted to do during the Holocaust, as Khmelnytsky, during the Khmelnytsky pogroms, would have liked to do had he had the technology. So Iran, which has declared its desire to do that, the current head of the Iranian Republican Guard, just after Soleimani's demise, was involved in the bombing of a Jewish community centre in Argentina. Not an Israeli target. It's a Jewish target. Why are they bombing Jews in Argentina? So, but that is the nature of it. They wanted to eliminate every Jew. As you probably know, the Wannsee Conference, during the preceding the Holocaust, the Germans had figures, had numbers of how many Jews lived everywhere in the world. It was not just about Lebensraum, finding living space and expanding into Sudetenland and Czechoslovakia, as it was called then, and Poland. It was about eliminating every Jew. They had the number of Jews in New Zealand. They had the number of Jews in Bandar Seri Begawan, North Brunei. They wanted to know where the Jews are, to eliminate every one of us. So there's an intensity about it. In addition, there's, I think, an irrationality about anti-Semitism. There are aspects of it, some of which you may have picked up as I was talking about the universality from the left, the right, etc., etc. So there's definitely an irrationality about it. To give you a few examples of that, the belief in deicide, the accusation that we killed God in the form of a human being, Jesus, we killed God. I mean, it's kind of interesting that to be accused of deicide is just bizarre. The blood libel. And blood libels happened. The most recent blood libel in the United States was in Messina, New York. I drove through there last summer on the way to Gananoque, so Thousand Islands. So Messina, New York. in the 1920s, there was a Christian girl disappeared one night, and the local police, it was just before, I think it was Yom Kippur, if I remember correctly, and someone asked a local Jewish storekeeper who knew nothing about Judaism, completely secular, completely disconnected from Judaism, they asked him, can you tell us absolutely, confirm absolutely that the Jews never have any need whatsoever for a Christian for any ritual purposes whatsoever? And he said, no. They said, aha. They called the rabbi of the town into the police department to ask him about the disappearance of the girl. There were some stores had their windows broken, some Jews got beaten up a little bit, but eventually the girl wandered back into town. She'd spent the night in the forest, she got lost. And you know what's interesting? After that, those who were behind the libel, who said that she was used for ritual purpose, they said, oh, the Jews heard that we discovered, they returned her. So the girl returns alive and unhurt, and the Jews are still blamed. It's incredible. And there is an irrationality of the blood libel in other areas, just to give you two examples. But it was believed that we would use the blood of Christians for various reasons. Initially, it was just to reenact the crucifixion once a year. Then later on, there were those who believed it was to be used for matzah. Some believed it was to... The Jews have a Jewish stench, a special smell that Jews have. And we need Christian blood to cure us of that Jewish stench. It's medieval belief. There was a belief in medieval times that Jewish men menstruated and needed Christian blood to cure male Jewish menstruation. I mean, this is really weird stuff, folks. This is somewhat irrational. And then, of course, I'll just mention the torturing of the host libel. Torturing the host doesn't mean staying too long at Shabbos lunch. We are guilty of that. But torturing the host means that the Jews were accused of stealing the wafer used in the Christian Catholic churches that was supposed to, in accordance with the doctrine of transubstantiation, turn into the body of Jesus. We were accused of stealing this wafer and stabbing it and torturing a cookie. And the Jews were accused, I mean, there were Jews massacred as a result of the accusation that we stole a wafer from a Catholic church and tortured this wafer and burnt it, put it into boiling oil, etc. The wafer, which, by the way, is eaten in the church. So you chew it and it gets digested and stuff, which evidently is not painful. But, so there's an irrationality of it. So, what is the idea? What does the Torah say about this? It's a vast, vast subject. Just to mention a few ideas. And this is in the spirit of something, an essay by Chaim Nachman Bialik, very great Hebrew poet. Chaim Nachman Bialik, the school I went to in Australia was known as Beit Sefer Chaim Nachman Bialik, Bialik School. Anyway, so Chaim Nachman Bialik wrote an essay called Chetzi Nechama. Chetzi Nechama means half of a consolation. Halfway consolation. And his essay was the following. He said, every single Jew knows that the whole blood libel thing is complete, utter rubbish. Complete drivel. Not a shred of truth to it. Every single Jew knows that the torturing of the host libel, complete rubbish. Not a shred of truth. Hogwash. Everyone knows that. And we are accused of it anyway. He says, so where is the nechama? Where is the comfort? He says, because all the other accusations, just like we know this one has not a shred of truth, the other ones too. He says, so there's a slight comfort in the accusations. If you accuse me of something absolutely ludicrous that makes no sense whatsoever, I feel a little better. If you accuse me of something which, maybe, who knows, right, etc. That's terrible. But he says there's a chetzi nechama. The Ritva, Rabbi Yontov ben Avraham Arashvili of Seville in Spain, the Ritva, one of our great Rishonim, he writes, there's such a thing as Nes L'ra'ah. Nes L'ra'ah literally means a miracle that is bad. Because the meaning of miracle is something which is clearly from Hashem. Something which is clearly divine. That's what we call a miracle. So he says, the Ritva says not all miracles necessarily are going to be good. A sign of something divine may be negative, depending on the situation, depending on the time and place. And the such thing as a nes l'ra'ah, meaning something miraculous in the sense that it tells me there's a God, in the sense that it tells me some truth which is supernatural, some truth which is above the variety, the variations of this world, and it's a nes, but it's not good. Anti-Semitism, I think, is one of those things. It's a nes l'ra'ah. There's a supernatural quality to it. As I mentioned, the universality, the irrationality, the intensity, the longevity, etc. Those are all features which don't really make sense according to the standard explanations that you find amongst various historians, whether it's the economic or whether it's the psychological or whether it's the scapegoat theory. All of those theories, they don't really explain all of those features. They don't quite do it. I think we have to resort to something beyond that. Menachem Begin, Prime Minister of the State of Israel, used to have a Torah study session in his office every week. It was a custom that started by Ben Gurion, and Menachem Begin continued it. I think Netanyahu does it too. So the Bible study group was interesting. Yehuda Avner, in his book The Prime Ministers, has a chapter about this. Fascinating. And they're studying the Parshas Balak. And there's a phrase there which describes the Jewish people as Am Levadad Yishkon, which means a people that will dwell alone, Uvagoyim Lo Yischashav, and will not be considered amongst the nations. Am Levadad Yishkon, a nation that will dwell alone and not be considered amongst the nations. And Menachem Begin had just come back from the United Nations. And he said, he started the session by saying, one does not have to be a mystic for the imagination to be stirred by such an improbable vision of a nation forever dwelling alone. Is it not a startlingly accurate prophecy of our Jewish people's experience in all of history? He'd come back from the United Nations, he had experienced the fact that Israel is a nation that dwells alone. We were not part of any regional group. Despite the fact that Israel does exist in a region, the Arab nations did not allow us to be part of the Middle Eastern regional group. The Asian nations did not consider part of the Asian regional group. Europeans said we're not in the European regional group. What regional group were we in? Good question. So Menachem Begin comes back and he says, Am Levadad Yishkon, it's a prophecy. One of the other people in the group, Professor Ephraim Orbach, author of many works on the Rishonim, he said that actually, he says, it's an imperative. The Jews are commanded to live alone. We actually have a command to be separate. In order to maintain our integrity, to maintain the Torah, there is actually a command to be a nation that lives alone. That is how he understood it. Also in the office at the time, with Nachama Leibovitz, great Torah commentator, professor at Hebrew University. My wife was a student of hers. And she says, Lo Yischashav, she says, the term, this is a people that should not be reckoned. They will not reckon themselves amongst nations. We will not look at ourselves as just another nation. We see ourselves as having a specific destiny, a specific goal, a specific task. Lo Yischashav, we won't consider ourselves one of the nations. We have a special task. And it's interesting, and we do stand apart. In Megillas Esther, which we're going to be reading not long, Megillas Esther, we are told, Haman accuses the Jews. He says, Gaseihen shonot mikol am. The Jews' religion and laws are different from all peoples. Obvious question here. According to the scroll of Esther, Ahasuerus, Chashiash, after Xerxes, ruled over 127 countries from India to Ethiopia. So Haman says the Jews are different. Lubavitcher Rebbe asked a fairly obvious question. 127 countries from India to Ethiopia, and only the Jews are different? What, everyone's a wasp? Literally, India to Ethiopia, 127 countries. Haman says the Jews are different. And Ahasuerus says, yeah, you're right. You're right, they are different. But, I mean, if you go to India, I mean, even in India alone, there are probably about 30 languages, there are 5 religions, there are every region, you know, if you're Desai, Kerala, Mumbai, they'll have completely different cultures. I mean, not completely different, but very different cultures, etc. Africa, there's something like, I don't know, something like 2,000 languages in South Africa, something like that. Was Jess, how many? Okay. Anyway, but so 2,000, something like that. Probably, yeah. Anyway, so but only the Jews are different. So Lubavitcher Rebbe answered brilliantly. He said what Haman was accusing the Jews of is the Jews are dafka different. Part of their religion is to be different. In other words, other nations are different if they happen to be different. Jews are different. Again, to quote Woody Allen, Jews are just like everyone else, only more so. But we are supposed to be different, and there's no question. And some of our commentaries have said that anti-Semitism is there as a reminder of Am Levadad Yishkon, that A, we are a nation that dwells alone. B, as Ephraim Orbach said, we are enjoined to actually be different and be and cling to our Torah and to our destiny and to our purpose. And C, as Nachama Leibovitz said, that to not consider ourselves the same as everyone else, but we have a unique heritage. And so that is one aspect of anti-Semitism. But it's interesting, there's a Rashi. Rashi tells us, this is in the in Parshas, in Bereishis, it says, Esav runs to greet his brother Yaakov. Vayaratz Esav. He sees his brother Yaakov, he hasn't seen him for years and years, and it says he embraces him. So the posuk says, Vayechabkehu, he hugged him. Vayipol al tzavarav, he fell upon his neck. Vayishakehu, and he kissed him. And if you look in the Torah scroll, above the word Vayishakehu, there are dots, nekudos. So Rashi tells us, why are there dots over the word Vayishakehu? It says because he brings two opinions, but one opinion he says is that he really wanted to bite Yaakov. He wanted to kiss him. He wanted to bite him. And he says a very famous statement. He says, Halacha b'yadua, there's a well-known halacha, law, which is a strange term to use, that Esav hates Yaakov. And I think to myself, why does he hate Yaakov? And this is not understood as a statement that every single non-Jew hates every single Jew. It's Esav hating Yaakov, his brother. But there, and the extent of it is a lot of, there's a lot of discussion about it. But the idea that Esav, what's he hate about Yaakov? He sees Yaakov, and Rashi gives us two explanations. He says he hates him, but then momentarily his compassion and love for his brother overtook him, and he kissed him. He wanted to bite him, but he kissed him. So there's type of like a relationship which is both love and hate. Esav sees his brother Yaakov, and he's overcome with hatred on the one hand, but he's also overcome with love on the other hand. What's the meaning of that? And as you probably know, there are non-Jews who are great supporters of the Jewish people and the State of Israel. I don't know if anyone has ever been to the Kufi Conference, Christians United for Israel. I was there a few years ago in Washington, D.C. I was sitting in a room with about 5,000 Christian Zionists. There are about 10 rabbis in the room. And on the stage was the choir of a church in Texas, and they were singing Yerushalayim Shel Zahav in beautiful Hebrew, and the people in the room were crying, except for the rabbis, but everyone else was overwhelmed with emotion. It was an amazing thing. And they sung Hatikva, and then the Christian college students were dancing the horror terribly, but they were dancing, they were trying to, it was very nice, right? To dance the horror to it was amazing. Right? So there are those who love us, there are those who support us, there are those who have, as we said, implacable hatred towards us. What's going on? What's the meaning behind it? We may understand this with another statement of the Gemara. The Gemara tells us in Megillah, sorry, the Gemara tells us in Shabbos, it says this, that when the death of Yaakov, Jacob, our patriarch, is described in the Torah, One word is missed out when it describes his passing away. The word death is not mentioned. He passed away, he expired, he was embalmed, he was buried, etc. But it doesn't actually say the words, Jacob died. It doesn't say that. So the Gemara picks up on this. It says, interesting. Why doesn't it say that he died? Interesting, why not? I mean, he did die. So the Gemara actually has an opinion. The Gemara in Tanis, Rabbi Yochanan says, Yaakov Avinu lo meis. Yaakov didn't die. So his colleagues asked him, and so explain to me, why did they mourn for him? Why did they eulogize him? They embalmed him. They put him in a coffin. And you're telling me he didn't die? So this is what Rabbi Yochanan says. Ma zaro b'chaim, his children are alive. Apu b'chaim, he's alive. Yaakov didn't die because his children are alive. The Maharal says, that's an interesting answer, because what about all the other people whose children are alive? There are plenty of people whose children are alive. Doesn't say about them, they didn't die. Specifically Yaakov. So Maharal explains, Yaakov was capable and was able and did transmit everything, all of his spirituality, all of his inheritance, all of his covenant with God to every single one of his children. Abraham did not succeed in that. He had a Yishmael. Yitzchak did not succeed in that. He had Esav. Yaakov succeeded in creating Jewish family, creating Jewish eternity through his family that would go on forever. And so therefore, Ma Zaro B'chayim, his children, us, are alive. Afu B'chayim, he is alive. So Yaakov and the Jewish people represent a certain eternal life. And I think that's what it is that Esav is bothered by. The Jewish people are this eternal people who are almost like, you know, there was a fellow by the name of Arnold Toynbee, who was a British historian. And Toynbee wrote a lengthy study, 8 volumes, and he invented the term fossils of history. He referred to the Jewish people as fossils of history. You know, so if you are walking, I used to live in Har Nof, in Yerushalayim, right near Har Nof, we go for hikes in the Jerusalem forest, and there was an area there where there's a flat stone with fossilized dinosaur footprints in the stone. Not a popular visiting place for Har Nof, people are scared of dinosaurs there. But I used to go there with the kids, there's fossilized dinosaur footprints, and obviously not scared, because they're fossilized footprints, that means they are very, very old. You have to worry about it. But if you would be on the beach in Costa Rica, in the wet sand, and you see a three-toed Velociraptor footprint in the wet sand, you have reason to be afraid. Because if it's in the wet sand, that means it's around and it's alive and kicking. And I think that's what people see in the Jewish people. For a Muslim and a Christian, there's a religious problem. Because from the Christian perspective, the Jewish people once were chosen. And in the words of one of my students, so we're frozen, they're chosen now? I said, yeah, that's how they look at it. We're frozen, they're chosen. So if we are frozen, we are a throwback of a history before the advent of Christianity. What are we doing alive and well in the land of Israel? What are we doing in Jerusalem? You have to look at Rabbi Blech's article, which I quoted here. You know, and for them, you know, Augustine, Chrysostom, Aquinas, they all said the Jews, because they rejected Jesus, they're now exiled from Israel, exiled from Jerusalem. They are now, they don't use the term, but fossils of history. So what happened in 1948? We came back to Israel. 1967, came back to Jerusalem. And we're doing pretty well. We're doing very well. There are something like over 6 million Jews in the land of Israel. We have a very good economy. We have hundreds of yeshivas. We have scientific publications being published in a language which was not used for daily speech for over 2,500 years, Hebrew. That's pretty amazing stuff. And for the Christian perspective, it's pretty disturbing, because the fossils have come back to life. The Muslims, many Muslims, have a belief that there is something called nusk. That means that we have become obsolete. There's an obsolescence which has been placed here. The Rambam tells us in the 13 principles of faith that there is no such thing as the Torah becoming obsolete. The Torah is eternal. And the choice of the Jewish people is eternal. So from a Muslim perspective, if they're the true inheritors of Abraham, the true inheritors of the Holy Land of Abraham, the true inheritors of monotheism in this world, why are the Jews there? The Jews should be dima. Dima, which means a protected but inferior minority, paying jizya, paying tax to the Muslim overlord. Instead, the Jewish people are proud. The Jewish people have their own country, their own anthem, their own flag. We're in the land of Israel. We're in the city of Jerusalem. We're speaking Hebrew. Pretty disturbing if you're a traditional Muslim who believes in Nusk, who believes in the obsolescence of Judaism. And if you... if you're a leftist or an atheist or an agnostic, it's also disturbing. Because there's something supernatural about the Jews. There's something otherworldly about the Jews and about our existence. We should be, it's like something getting out of the museum, night at the museum. Some Etruscan statue in the museum gets up and starts walking around and eating herring and stuff like that, as the Etruscans did, I'm sure. It's weird. So whether you're a Christian or a Muslim or an atheist, Jews and our existence is disturbing. Am levadad, we are I translate that maybe a little differently. Am levadad yishkom, we are a unique nation. We are, so to speak, a fossil. And it's interesting, Abba Ivan, who was at the time was the Israeli ambassador to the United States, came to speak at Yeshiva University in 1955. And there's a transcript of his speech in the Israel Studies magazine. And Abba Ivan had just given his address. And at the end of the address, he says the following. He says, if the concept of Judaism, if Israel was a fossil centuries ago, then its survival is an archaism and its restoration is a grotesque paradox. On the other hand, if the concept of Judaism as something petrified and embalmed cannot be sustained, it is difficult to challenge the right of a sentient living spirit to seek survival and restoration. If we are not embalmed, like Yaakov apparently was, if we are not in a coffin, if we're not fossilized, then how can you deny our right to live? How do you deny our right to have our own country? How do you deny our right to be a sovereign nation? Only if you say the Jews are fossils can you deny that. Professor Toynbee fails to substantiate the fossil theory, despite the fact that it is the absolute premise and starting point of all his subsequent judgments, because Toynbee was an opponent of the existence of the State of Israel, an opponent of the existence of the Jews as independent nationality. And I'll end with how Abba Ivan ended his speech to Yeshiva University in 1955. He says, but the fossil, not having read Dr. Toynbee's 8 volumes, is unaware of its own petrification. It clings to its sense of mission and strives for national restoration. We Jews are not aware of the fact that we're fossilized. We think we're alive, because we are. And we're alive and kicking and well. And the fact that there is anti-Semitism is because deep down, for a lot of people, when they see a Jew, especially a Jew identifying as a Jew, especially a Jew who looks more like a fossil, they see that it makes them angry. On the part of some, it inspires them. But on the part of some, it makes them angry. Because their entire worldview is disturbed. The worldview that nations go in and out of vogue, that nations become extinct, that nations become fossilized, that one covenant overrides another, that one testament overrides another, that one prophet overrides another, that all, in the face of Jewish existence, survival, thriving, and success, is contradicted. And so therefore, as Chaim Nachman Bialik said, there's a chetzi nechama, there's a comfort in anti-Semitism. The comfort I get from anti-Semitism is A, it's a nes l'ra'ah, it's a miraculous manifestation of Hashem's divine providence, his reminder to us that we are indeed Am Levadad Yishkon, have a destiny, have a purpose, have a uniqueness, number one. Number two, it's a reminder to me that deep down everyone recognizes the same truth that I see. But for me, when I see Jewish survival, Jewish success, the state of Israel, etc., I hear the footsteps of the Messiah. So if you are Jewish, if you are a devoted member of our community, hearing the footsteps of the Messiah is not something to be afraid of, it's something to be inspired by. If you are on the outside and you hear the footsteps of the Messiah, that's like something creepy coming into your house in the middle of the night. That's something to be scared of, that's something to be horrified by, and that's something which expresses, arouses, and exacerbates the hate. So for us, however, what we hear in the hatred is the footsteps of the Messiah. What we hear in the hatred is our uniqueness, our destiny, and our special character. And as Menachem Begin said, you don't have to be a mystic to hear the prophecy of Am Levadad Yishkon. You just have to be a good Jew and to continue in the path of survival and success and in the path of keeping our destiny and enjoining us to learn that Torah, to learn that destiny, and that we too will be part of Yaakov Avinu Lomeis, just as Jacob didn't die. We, the Jewish people, his children, will not die. We, the Jewish people, his children, will not be erased. And as we always say, as Rosh Hashanah Kalevich sing beautifully, Am Yisrael Chai, the Jewish nation lives.